I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Doran, and this is Radio versus the Martians.
The one thing my personal take on video game violence, the one thing that's a little dangerous, I do think that video games set in extraordinary settings are less relatable to the world than something like a Grand Theft Auto. Not saying Grand Theft Auto makes anyone commit real acts of violence. I will say that I have been stuck in traffic next to a taxi and had that moment where I think I could go run some taxi missions, and then I realized it's the real world. So there are psychological triggers in Grand Theft Auto and games like that, that I can connect to things in the real world. But because I'm sane, I recognize the distinction. You know, I'm not in a video game right now.
Or are you?
But again, like you said, there's a sanity veto. That there's a point at which, like, everyone has those thoughts, but how many people carry those thoughts out? Everyone has been in a conversation with someone they really hate, and you have that image in your face of, you know, like that bit in True Lies where he snaps the neck of Bill Paxton who's sitting in the car next to him, and it's just a fantasy sequence.
Yeah.
You have those fantasies, but you don't snap the guy's neck in real life.
I mean, in real life, I couldn't snap the guy's
and
neck.
And I couldn't either. I am not, especially with one hand while driving, I am not Arnold Schwarzenegger. But there are things that you can do in a video game. And even to the degree that I play Grand Theft Auto, I am not a monster in the same way I think a lot of other people are. You know that in playing Bioshock, where you have the option to either save a little sister or harvest a little sister, I have never harvested a little sister.
Oh, man.
And I had to find out what
you didn't get that achievement or something, did you?
To find out what that looked like, I had to look it up on YouTube.
Wow. See, snuff film. Bioshock snuff film on
YouTube. But and that's the same thing. Is for a long time, Grand Theft Auto 5 was the first game where I found myself doing any kind of mayhem. And it was because I was playing, what is the name of the character on there that he's kind of the...
Oh, he's a substitute for the most ridiculous Grand Theft Auto player.
Yeah, that he seems to be a...
Trevor? Trevor, yeah.
Trevor is a character that I find myself doing stuff like that with. It feels like I'm being true to Trevor. But again, I think Trevor is an absolute commentary on who they think their fans are.
Yeah.
But I didn't do it while I was playing Michael or Franklin. I would only do it when I played Trevor, who was sort of this depraved, violent guy. And but even then, a lot of times when I play Grand Theft Auto, I go out of my way to not run people down. For a long time, I used to like instinctively apologize if I hit somebody with my car. I'm just trying to kill that guy over there who is a bad guy. You're just wandering by.
So Trevor does have... There's been a few moments in video games where I'm like, whoa, this crosses a line for me.
The torture sequence is awful.
I almost stopped playing the game during that sequence.
You don't have a way not to do it. You're not given the option to say no.
And I want to role play in these games too. I understand that you have to have a thread of a storyline, but anytime that you force me to take a series of actions and I don't have a way to... You know, my only way not to do it is to turn off the video game.
Yeah.
I don't appreciate
it. I do agree with that. And I think that's kind of like, you know, press X to mourn or whatever.
Pay respects.
It's that kind of shit.
I don't want to.
It's, you know, if you're going to do it as a cutscene and take me out of it. Don't make me make Trevor do it. Just have Trevor do it.
I just realized here that we've got sort of a mini reunion for our Bioshock panel here, because Patrick, you were on Bioshock.
That's right.
There was a moment there which is get baptized. In the beginning of Infinite, you go up to Columbia. To enter Columbia, you have to be baptized. And I remember reading somewhere that there was a certain small number of people who requested refunds from Steam. Because they did not want to be baptized. So I was like, well, that's pretty extreme, but
yeah,
I thought that sequence was actually really well done.
I think the thing that makes it work with those elements in the Bioshock games is that the whole point of the Bioshock games, I think, is the illusion of choice.
Yeah.
That you think that you're playing a character who's making choices because that's how they sold the game, as you're going to make these choices and the choices make you. But the whole point of it is that you're an automaton being manipulated the whole time, or that you're somebody who has no choice and It's like the Dr. Manhattan in The Watchmen, which is essentially a puppet who can see their own strings. And it's a commentary on, and it's only a kind of commentary that can exist in a video game,
yeah.
which is a story that you control, but finding out that your control is really just simulated too, that you're really not making choices as a player. And that's the defining, that's why I don't think you can make a BioShock movie and have that same impact, because the viewer is passive in a movie in a way that they aren't in a video game, and you're not making those choices. So I don't know. I really don't know. Cause again, BioShock is another terrifically violent game. But it also has kind of a heightened reality to it.
Right. And so the fact, the world that it creates and the way in which the violence manifests, it doesn't to me, the fact that it is so unreal puts it in a different category in my mind than, there are violent video games that take place in a more realistic setting. I'm not saying that there's any sort of causality to real violence, but those do challenge me in a way that is different. Like, what if you made a AAA video game in which you had the choice to go shoot up a school?
They did that actually with Postal. I don't know if it had I don't know if it was a school, but this was around when going postal became a meme because there were ex or current postal employees who were returning to shoot up their workplace because of the stress, and they made a series of two video games. I think.
Played the first one. I played for Postal 1.
And there was Postal 2, which I think was even more absurd and more ridiculous. But it's about that, where it's functionally a sort of a murder revenge simulator where you're let off the hook. You're let off the hook, and the world is heightened and ridiculous. Like, there's a button that lets you urinate.
Like, I mean, when that's clearly a cartoon, even if it's not something.
It's totally a cartoon. But obviously, at the time, this was sort of like Tipper Gore rating system pearl clutching nonsense, you know, where it was like, oh my god, it's terrible, like, what's it doing?
And the thing is, I can look at it too and say that's pretty tasteless and stupid, but not want to ban it. And at the same time, I guess the difference, again, talking about the level of realism, is that when it feels like it's, I'm not one of those people who believes that any action act of graphic violence in a work of fiction is the glorification of it, in the same way that any attitude in a movie, I think that's an incredibly obtuse way of taking in any media, is assuming that portraying anything is glorifying it. Otherwise, is Stephen Colbert glorifying the people he's satirizing when he was that character he played
they
on
thought so,
for years?
In many cases.
Yeah, because that's just because you're dealing with dumb people. But, I mean, it's the degree in which I start to feel like there is a prescriptive awfulness to it. That do make me uncomfortable. Like I mentioned that with the original Death Wish, is that there is a descriptive or prescriptive kind of attitude of, you know, maybe we all should do this. The Dirty Harry movies have a lot of this too, where it's almost like this kind of desperate desire for a kind of authoritarian fascism, rather that the sort of freedoms and rights that we give to people that we don't think deserve them are putting us in danger. And that we have to respond to that. That's the stuff that makes me uncomfortable, when I start to feel like it's not the point of view of a character, but it's the point of view of the creator or filmmaker or writer that's saying that. That's when that gets uncomfortable.
I don't know. I mean, I think for me, it's when something crosses over the territory into clearly being mean-spirited. And not mean-spirited in a way of like, in a way of like, well, I'm not being sensitive, but in a way where you've automatically jettisoned the idea that there's any way or need to explain why this has ended up happening, and there's just cruelty that ends up happening.
It's kind of like fictional bullying.
Yeah.
The idea of punching down, the idea that it's funny that bad thing happened to that person. That's one of the reasons that I hate Adam Sandler movies.
I'm just
going to
say the same sort of thing, is that those movies are unwatchable to me for that reason.
Because there is a sense of the humor in an Adam Sandler movie, for all the people who scream about Rey being a Mary Sue in the Star Wars movies, which is bullshit, by the way, the part of the Mary Sue that they don't understand is the authorial in self-injection.
Yeah.
That somebody's living vicariously through this fictional character. And the biggest Mary Sue in all of cinematic history are the characters that Adam Sandler plays. Because Adam Sandler is never the butt of the jokes. The jokes are they're directed outward. I'm just this goofy, lovable, regular guy who occasionally flies into a violent rage and attacks somebody. And in every one of these movies, he's always the best at sports. Better than his friends. He's always the best at fighting. It's like this is what a 13-year-old boy thinks an adult is. He's regularly zinging everyone else, and none of the jokes are ever directed at him.
He usually is just wealthy for no reason. He just is by default, just incredibly wealthy.
He's always married to somebody like Salma Hayek.
Right.
Where it's just like, and he's always just wearing cargo shorts and a t-shirt all the time. And he's just like some schlubby guy who has a perfect life and nothing bad ever gets directed at him. It always kind of like the joke is, ha, it's funny because that guy in a wheelchair accidentally got his hand with like a staple gun or something. Or I'm laughing at that guy because he's got a speech impediment. Or it's funny because that old lady fell down. Or, oh, look at that guy's voice is funny because he's deaf. I mean, there's this bullying aspect of it that's sort of very pervasive where it's like, is this how Biff Tannen sees himself?
Wait, but what about Waterboy?
Waterboy. No. It's like, then there's things like that where they're just fucking stupid.
Here's a question. So we're talking about the umbrella term of an Adam Sandler movie, and now he's directing them, right? So they're more than ever, more than a Billy Madison or something, they're an Adam Sandler movie. Do you consider Punch Drunk Love to be an Adam Sandler movie, or does it not fall because it's not him and it's not that kind of
thing? No, it's a Paul Thomas Anderson movie that has him in it, and it's
even though he's still playing that sort of like I'm getting upset kind of character, but ultimately a little lovable, even though he's off his kilter.
It's also dramatic and it's self-aware in a way those other ones aren't. Like he doesn't ever pay for his outlandish behavior, like in the one where he's a hockey player becomes a golfer. Not Billy Madison, but Happy Gilmore.
Happy Gilmore.
In Happy Gilmore, there's times where he just flies into a violent rage and destroys like a mini golf thing, like Clown Head. He doesn't pay for that. There's never a point where he pays for his behavior.
You're gonna die, clown.
People don't even get upset with him.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing of like Punch Drunk Love is a movie with him struggling with that and the pain that it causes. In the same way that like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is not a Jim Carrey movie. It's a movie that has Jim Carrey in it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the best thing Adam Sandler has and probably will ever do, because it's somebody else's vision and not his kind of schlubby, goofy, I'm going to essentially scam a studio into giving me $40 million to goof around with my friends and make fun of the handicapped. Because that's essentially what it fucking is. It's monstrous. And again, it's a Biff Tannen fan film. And except the fact that people forget that Biff Tannen's the bad guy.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything Sandler's done in the last 10 years, I think, or anything by design. But he has such a... His niche is so well sort of crafted out at this point that Punch Drunk Love, just by virtue of the fact that it isn't that one thing, is in a completely separate category. And I can't think of another film that he's done off the top of my head.
He was in the Meyerowitz Stories, which is that Noah Baumbach movie that was on Netflix with another guy whose name is not going to be mentioned all that much. Dustin Hoffman, his less known brother. Dustin Hoffman was in it, and Ben Stiller is in it. And it's a Noah Baumbach movie, so it's about New York, people in New York who have relationships.
Okay. Is it any good?
I liked what he did in that. Since I'm a stay-at-home dad, I liked that he had played a character who is getting divorced now that his daughter is going to college, and he spent basically this kid's entire life being a stay-at-home dad and is now faced with the reality of, oh, I might have to go back and live with my eccentric dad, who's played by Dustin Hoffman. And he's definitely, it's one of those things where he's best when he's pulled all of that shit, all that Adam Sandler shit, all the way back. He's walked it all the way back, and he just has to inhabit a character that might have a few little quirks, but he has to behave like a real person. And that's the one thing, is that Adam Sandler in Adam Sandler movies doesn't behave like a real person. He behaves like Adam Sandler, who is doing a stand-up routine in a movie.
Because
right?
he's got to yell like that all the time, and he's got to flip out. And again, there's that desperate, weird need that his character has to show other people that he can beat them up. It's weird. It happens in like Mr. Deeds. It happens in Happy Gilmore. It happens in Billy Madison.
I think I stopped watching them with Little Nicky. I think that was the one. I think the one before that was Big Daddy. That was the one with Jon Stewart in
it.
That's
where I cut out.
Yeah, and then I think Little Nicky was the next one, and I'm like, this is fucking stupid. And I think, beside from Punch Drunk Love,
is that before or after Wedding Singer?
That's after.
After. Yeah, after Wedding Singer.
Wedding Singer is almost not an Adam Sandler movie.
Yeah, I agree.
It dances on the line a bit, but it's not quite.
That's not true. I saw the one about short-term memory loss with Drew Barrymore. I saw that one. That was like in mid-2000s.
Memento?
No, Memento?
Memento. Yes,
or Adam Sandler is like, oh yeah, I really like hockey. And then he's going to go beat the... Oh, I'm going to beat the shit out of this guy.
I would really want to see that scene in Adam Sandler starring in Memento when he has to drink the glass of water that the whole bar is spit in. I would definitely want
to
see
that. Can I volunteer to spit in that glass?
So an interesting thing is that now Adam Sandler has a platform that is not going away.
Oh,
which
yeah,
is
Netflix.
That Netflix is just handing him just blank checks.
And, it's like 8 movie deal or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that he has enough of a dedicated fan base that don't care about the quality of what he puts out. I've heard conspiracy theories that Jack and Jill was basically about, let's make the worst movie we possibly can and people will still pay for it anyway.
It's like the producers?
it'll make more money yeah, being a flop.
I guess
but it wasn't
so.
A flop, though. They must make, he doesn't, they must make enough money. Obviously, they wouldn't keep.
Yeah, I mean, if you really want to watch an extensive deconstruction of this, Red Letter Media has a Jack and Jill review that's probably longer than the movie itself.
That's how they roll, yeah.
Basically, they make the argument that Adam Sandler movies are an outright scam.
Yeah.
It's definitely worth watching.
Yeah.
I would say track that down, but they do make a pretty compelling argument there because I don't know why these movies are expensive as they are to essentially look like Saturday Night Live sketches. They look cheap. They essentially get a lot of stunt casting cameos and things from his friends.
So we're spending all this time talking shit about Adam Sandler. I want you both to say something nice about Adam Sandler. Mike, go.
Since he's on Netflix, I don't have to see him as much. I will say this, something actually positive. When he appears in other people's movies that are written for him, like Paul Thomas Anderson, he can create a good performance. If he works with Paul Thomas Anderson or Noah Baumbach or any of these guys, he can be good. He just chooses not to be.
Patrick?
I love the Hanukkah song. So actually, Adam Sandler for me, I like early Adam Sandler.
Yeah.
The magic really wore off, you know, the shine really wore off for me. To me, it's part of, I used to have what I called the Chevy Chase syndrome, which is that you have a comedian that what they do works when they're young and energetic. And then the more that they keep trying to do the same shtick, they find that they just don't have whatever made them funny in the first place.
Hmm.
Adam Sandler, to me, just hasn't been likable, hasn't been funny, and he's still trying to play these characters where he can get away with being terrible because you're supposed to like him anyways. And you said something nice about him, huh?
Yeah. he's terrible, but, you know.
Happy Gilmore and the other one.
Billy Madison.
Billy Madison. I was, you know, 14 or something when I saw them, but I had a lot of fun with them, and no regrets there.
Those are those doldrums that we always talk about, where you like the most regrettable stuff when you look back on it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, being 14 and 15, my taste was awful.
Yeah.
I mean, you should see.
Hey, I love the Judge Dredd movie.
You should see the Spawn comics I used to buy back then.
I think the most regrettable.
Actually, weirdly enough, Spawn comics have aged better than you imagine.
I'm sure they have. I was thinking about this. I used to like Rob Schneider a lot more, and it only took me watching the first 7 minutes of Rob Schneider's Netflix show, which I guess any Saturday Night Live comedian who's still operating can get a Netflix show now if they want to. I only needed to watch like the first 4 minutes to be like, this isn't funny, you're not funny, and I don't like you. So I don't know what I would have ever seen in Rob Schneider.
It sounds like something you folded up, sent in a letter, and just mailed it to him.
Yeah.
Dear Rob Schneider, you're not funny,
I
don't like you.
I think I like the sensitive naked man. I think that was probably my favorite one of his bits, when it was just him sitting on a couch naked, and the interlocutor is always saying, it's because you're naked, and he always says, I don't think that's the real issue here.
Just looking, I guess we're talking, other people have probably talked about this in more in depth.
Also, Rob Schneider in a lot of Adam Sandler movies.
Oh, yeah. And if you really wanted to see the best thing written about Rob Schneider, my favorite thing ever was a review of Deuce Bigelow 2 has written by the great late Roger Ebert.
Oh, no.
It's worth tracking that review down. It may be one of the, it only spends about a paragraph talking about the movie. Goes off on a wonderful tirade where he just builds the perfect. It's like watching somebody build a catapult and then fire it. And it's just done by the master. Roger Ebert, gone before his time.
Of course.
But I guess looking at this, I guess with Netflix, we talked about people who seem to fall to Netflix. But Netflix also does create a lot of really good original stuff, too. I mean, it's not like Stranger Things is something that is only on Netflix because it sucks. It's not like Orange is the New Black was only on Netflix because it sucks, or that House of Cards is only on Netflix because it sucks. I mean, these are things that could have been picked up by AMC or HBO.
Yeah, the real, I think I understand Netflix's push towards having a lot of quantity. I think they're clearly spending a lot of money producing a lot of shows that are for a shit ton larger spectrum of a demographics than any of the networks are doing right now. They're clearly trying to branch out in all areas. I think the thing that I'm confused about is the movie part of it, because I think the series part they have locked down. I think people are going to be subscribed to Netflix almost indefinitely because they're going to have a Stranger Things, you know, they're going to have at least one or two of those going at any given time, which will be worthwhile watching. It'll probably be after the Disney one. Maybe people will think there's a little less value once Disney sort of rips away all the Marvel stuff. But the movie thing is the thing that really, I'm not sure what they're doing with it. And I'm not sure if they're going to continue, because they're expensive. They're expensive and they don't fly as much as a series does.
Maybe I'm not seeing the silver lining for the clouds right now, but I can't think of a great original film that came out through Netflix.
There's a few.
Please name them, because I'm thinking about is a Ridiculous Six right now.
So I haven't actually seen the ones that are best critically reviewed. I think there's a bunch of stuff that they put on to film circuits that, mm-hmm. you know, that they're trying to get away.
I liked Okja.
Yes, it was Okja. There was the
Mudbound. The new one was really good. I would say that's very, very good.
What was the one with the? There was an African warlord movie.
Beasts of the no, not Beasts. Of the
that's what
Wild.
I wanted to say too.
Not Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Beasts of No Nation.
Beast of No Nation.
Yeah. So they have been putting out some stuff. It's an interesting fight right now where there are film. I think Cannes said that they're not going to take Netflix stuff anymore.
Oh, really?
Or maybe at least there was some controversy about whether or not you needed to be a traditional movie theater cinema thing. And so Netflix, they've been releasing some of their stuff into one theater just so that they can be a candidate for some of these film festivals. And there's an old media versus new media push. I do understand the quantity thing just because they need to have. As more and more studios who own a piece of Hulu want to just move all their migrate all their right. content there, you need enough of a reason to have people coming back. I do think the series have been stronger than the films, but I like that they're willing to take chances. You know, Mute be an example of that. Look, Duncan Jones,
yeah, Duncan Bowie.
Yeah, he doesn't have a lot of credits to his name. You know, he made.
Wait, is he David Bowie's kid?
Yeah.
Holy shit!
You didn't know that?
No.
So he made this. The stuff that I recognized was Moon, the Warcraft movie. Yeah.
Whoa! Wait! Stop! What?
And then this? Yeah, I couldn't believe. Why would I'm not sure why they trusted him with the Warcraft movie, considering the budget of it.
Because that's the mode now for doing these huge budget. Big tent blockbusters, well, CGI blockbusters, is you get a Rian Johnson or something.
You go from Looper to Star Wars.
Exactly right. That's how you do it. Is you don't get a Spielberg or whatever. You don't get a Brian De Palma or some shit like that. You find someone who has made a good movie on $30 million and you give them $150 million. And so you do a property like Warcraft, which that's a lock in, right? How many people spent the best years of their lives playing Warcraft? How many millions of people are there?
It's somebody who has the ability to make a good move, a good film that has compelling characters and a coherent story, but they don't have the clout of like a Brian De Palma right. or of a Steven Spielberg who could say, no, I don't want to do that and win a fight with a studio.
But so Moon is a great movie with one character, really.
Yeah.
And World of Warcraft, I actually tried to watch at one point, and the Uncanny Valley was too great for me. It's just too many CGI characters, and I just couldn't.
That thing, I haven't seen Warcraft at all, but the design of the orcs, based on what I saw, was a little off-putting because it seemed a little Roger Rabbit-y. Not because I don't think that people can make an orc work in that, but the design of an orc seems to be one that would exist against another animated character rather than against a live-action human. They're a little too cartoony.
Well, I mean, we know that it's possible from the Apes movies, the new Apes trilogy. You know that it's possible to do it and to, if not totally, almost totally kill Uncanny Valley by having motion capture performance be top-notch and then having the CGI be just that fucking good.
Yeah, I think that the Planet of the Apes reboots are really kind of go under the radar for the praise that they should get for the quality of CGI characters. That they're the only ones. Them and kind of in the beginning of Ant-Man where they de-aged Michael Douglas. That was pretty incredible. He looked really good in that. But normally it sets off those same alarm bells. But I think it wasn't how well I think they did the orcs, because I haven't seen that movie. The design of the orcs seems to imply a more cartoon Pixar world than one that coexists with live action actors. And you're not going for Roger Rabbit. So it seems like they would have just kind of pulled that back, the design wise, to make it so that they don't stick out as much like a sore thumb. Or just make it a CGI animated movie Pixar style.
Yeah. I didn't see it, but the trailer just looked to me like Rise of the Planet of the Lord of the Rings is what it looked like. It looked like CGI motion capture of, you know, other baddies with like a, you know, like a Tolkien story, and you smash them together.
So interestingly, the movie, Warcraft, I want to get back to Netflix, but Warcraft was a flop in the US, huge hit in China.
Yeah.
Which makes it all viable.
It seems like China's, not to stereotype, but it
not
seems
to
like
diss on China.
It seems like CGI spectacle does really well there.
Yeah, well, there are some, you know, there are types of movies that have always played well internationally and some types that don't. Action movies always play better internationally because you don't need to worry so much about portraying, you know, there are cultural differences and dubbing versus subtitling and stuff. Sometimes there are just, you know, most relationship dramas do not play well overseas.
Yeah, the cultural differences. Yeah. But I mean, looking at the Transformers movies, they always do way better in China than they do in the United States. Maybe not to slam my own countrymen, but I just assume that those things are so dumb they do better here. But they don't. I don't really know why that is.
Hopefully we will not have another Transformers reboot series of movies, but do you think they've made too much money to just not move on to another director? And
we are going to have Transformers movies until we're both long dead.
They're going to get bought by Disney.
But, getting back to connection, these tissues again, talking about both Netflix and Warcraft, pulling that together. Did you guys see Bright?
Yes, yeah.
No, that, I haven't.
Oh, God. Again, talking about tone deaf and...
Yeah, no, it's...
Didn't they make the orcs the blacks, and they like, the Latinos the elves?
But you know how long I've wanted rated for a Shadowrun movie?
That was the one thing that I was like, whoa, this is Shadowrun. That's cool.
The dangerous thing of being a nerd, is that you want something so bad. Dude, I'm a superhero fan. Believe me, I know. The stuff that I used to put up with before there was a glut of superhero movies, I used to love the Captain America movie starring J.D. Salinger's kid. but that thing is awful, by the way. But you're just excited to see something in live action. I think with Bright, though,
this is David Ayer, right?
This is David Ayer doing, I think on its face, I think there's the beginnings of something that seems like a cool idea, which is...
there's some cool world building there.
Yeah. I think the problem with it is that it's so ham-fistedly done because it's trying to cram it all into 90 minutes, where this is the kind of world building you really need an ongoing series for. That the general premise behind Bright...
But who can afford Will Smith for, you know, a series?
Not possible.
You can get Joel Edgerton and somebody else.
Martin Lawrence. I mean, just swap him out for Martin Lawrence.
If Will Smith wants to do a TV show, even if it's just for a season, I mean, you could do sort of a True Detective thing and just do different stories in this world, and that could be cool. I think that the problem is that there's too much stuff in Bright. And the idea is that Lord of the Rings or something similar to it happened 2,000 years ago, and now we're living in sort of a modern world. It's like nobody ever projects forward in the Lord of the Rings to what kind of world is there going to be. There's all these leftover orcs after Sauron is defeated or whatever. And the problem, though, is that the tone deaf part of it is that they code them so heavily as urban African Americans, rather than doing the Star Trek thing of saying, well, we're talking about this, but we're creating a unique culture. It's so coded in that it becomes really uncomfortable. And you can really tell that at times the movie is clearly made by a white guy of our age. And I mean, it's again, the sort of,
so this is the thing. So Will Smith read this script.
Yeah. There's some really
thought, oh yeah, this is how I want to be representing this movie.
And there's also some lines that are really poorly thought out, like fairy lives don't matter. And I mean, you're just like, oh Jesus Christ, don't do that. There's some awful shit like that in this movie. And it's the fact that they're so heavily coded as black characters,
so,
including jerseys and their own version of kind of orc rap, and it's so uncomfortable at times.
So I would say to you, Casey, and to all our listeners, watch the first 15 minutes of it. You get everything that you really need to. By the time that the plot really starts, then you're done. You can just like turn it off.
No, this is a constant problem that I have, especially with movies that do great world building, is that sometimes the best part, like Valerian. Is this for me? Is the first 10 or 15 minutes are just so fucking good. I felt like also with almost every single Ridley Scott movie in the Aliens, is also, I love the first 10 or 15 minutes, but after that, I just check out totally. There's this great thing when you were this sort of sumptuous experience at drinking in a new world, a new sort of visualization of a new world, and especially with visual filmmakers that can do it so well, that's often the most enjoyable part. But I don't understand why they just fall apart. Why a lot of them are just like, you can't take, you know, it can't be like a, I'll use this, like a Blade Runner sort of thing, where it gets more interesting when you start to realize that it's not, that the backdrop to the story is interesting in and of itself, and that feeds the motivations of the characters and the scenarios they're put in and how they're able to respond and ultimately how the conflict will resolve itself based on the way that the world actually is.
Well, I think a lot of the problems with Bright is that there's too many elements in this world to fit into a 90-minute movie. That if you want the thing that I always kind of come back to, whether it's the problems with Spider-Man 3 or any of these things, which is there's too much stuff in this movie. You got to start breaking out the scalpel and getting down to just the stuff that makes it easier to fade into the world. You can add all the things with the elves. Like, the elves are barely an issue. There's the idea of sort of a 1% elf overclass that sort of exists, but they never really come into the plot, and that the bad guys are sort of these rogue elves who aren't representative of the other elves, and nobody really talks about the 1% elves, and there's like centaurs and all these other things that exist there. But they just kind of seem like a distraction at times if you're not going to space this out so that those moments of exposition can feel organic in the moment, rather than somebody stop and go, oh yeah, so this happened and then that happened and that happened. I think that if you just wanted to do a movie, cut out everything in the past except for just the orcs and humans. And if you want to make a statement about racism, and you can do something with that, make them so not A to A, apple to apple, commentary on a specific race that has all of these really dicey racial issues, especially when a movie's being made by somebody who is not part of that marginalized group.
Yeah.
Separating of that can still allow you to say something Star Trek style about something or about cultures or about parts of being human or about racism without dealing with it directly. But it's almost barely a veneer over just doing a movie about racism in Los Angeles. I also think that it feels like there's a really great performance by Joel Edgerton, who I really think is brilliant in this movie. And I really would have preferred he be the lead character of this film and not Will Smith. Because in a weird sort of way, it just kind of feels like a much more convoluted version of the movie Alien Nation.
Oh.
Which, it's a lot easier to do Alien Nation because you have a world that you understand and you inject one thing into it. But the problem with this world is that you have this entire multi-thousand year prehistory, and you want to believe that you can inject things like orcs and stuff into it without radically changing Earth history. Where if you look at something like, say, Watchmen, one person like Dr. Manhattan changes this much about history, where yeah. Nixon is still president and we have electric cars and all this shit. Where if magic existed, even just magic wands that can do anything, it would radically change our world history. That things don't, there's no way to fit orcs and shit into like World War II. I mean, then that would be almost the joy of watching that unfold in a TV show, of really going, how much different would this world be, saying the past was Lord of the Rings? We're not going to have the same kind of looking anything, and it's a lot harder to make that movie. So I'd say with Alien Nation, you can just have every Earth history goes exactly the same, and then in this year, aliens show up. It's a lot easier to do. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing to attempt it. I'm saying that this movie wasn't up to the task of the Herculean thing that's set for itself.
Yeah, so the thing that makes it kind of work is that you can take, people are familiar enough with fantasy tropes, so you can say this is a fantasy universe, but set in a recognizable, somewhat present day. And that this sort of transposition is easy enough. So when centaurs show up, it's not like, whoa, centaurs. it's sort of, well, there's fairies and orcs and elves. I guess there'd be centaurs. The way that it doesn't work is that there isn't enough space to really flesh out the dynamics that they're creating. This is a movie in a lot of ways about class and about race and about how they interact and about how those power structures. And it just does, it's not deft enough. I had the same feeling that what they were doing was just too transparent, too bald on its face in some places. There are some of the issues are different. The reason that people hate the orcs is because they were on the side of the Dark Lord, you know, some time ago. But there are some also questions about, what is the... There are some things that orcs are, like, physically built for, that they're, you know, orcs are not going to play basketball, but they can be linebackers because they're sort of meaty and strong. And, you know, elves maybe represent the upper class because they... everybody knows if you want a spellcaster, you don't roll orc. You know, it's but trying to take some of those issues that exist in a role playing environment and transpose them into something realistic means that you have to deal with all the real life consequences of some of these things, and it doesn't handle that very well.
So here's the real question to end all questions about Bright, since we know this is going to be a universe. What do you think about Bright 2? Is it a good idea? Can some of these things be improved by having the second one?
Could it be? Yes. Will it be? Probably not.
Yeah.
I think I don't have faith that they're going to fix it, but I think if... It's almost a let's go back to formula sort of thing with it. There is a neat idea in there. It's like, again, with Prometheus, there's a good idea there, but it's just they did it in the most convoluted way that undermined it. And actually... injected a lot of problematic stuff into it that didn't need to be there, because there was, again, when a well-meaning person who really doesn't know what they're talking about tries to tackle a thorny issue and it kind of blows up in their face and you're like, no, you don't seem like you're with it. You just kind of seem like this probably wasn't the best story for you to tell, or you had to tell it in a radically different way.
Sure, sure.
And again, I don't know how I would fix a TV show. Again, it would allow this world building to slowly unfold, that maybe you see hints of the elf thing, but that doesn't become a storyline until a few issues in. Let it build slowly so people aren't constantly saying, oh, in 2,000 years ago, blah, blah, blah happened. Let that kind of come out in bits and pieces. And that was one of the things, again, to make a counter positive example, which I think are better than just ragging on this thing. like the movie Logan.
Yeah.
The movie Logan, have you seen Logan yet, Patrick?
Yep.
There is a backstory about what happened to the X-Men that is answered in that movie, but it's answered very piecemeal. And if you pay attention to the movie, you can figure out what it is. But it never feels like anything is stopped and explained or done with a gratuitous flashback. They just kind of let the viewer kind of piece that stuff together. I think... Bright needed a lot more of that. And like you mentioned, it isn't a deft hand at what it's attempting. That there is somebody who could have made a much better movie about this. Like, not to completely spoil, but this movie's been out for a while, Bright. The big thing at the end is there's only a small selection of people in the world, like a 1 in a million shot that if you find a magic wand, that if you pick it up, you're probably going to explode unless you're a special sort of person called a Bright.
So just real quick. Guess who?
Yeah. That's the thing that's shitty
Joel
about
Edgerton's orc.
No, that's who it should have been.
Yeah.
It should have been that. The idea that this person has been sort of trashed on and told that you're shit and that you people are garbage people, but he's the special one who should have been able to be the chosen one. It shouldn't have been Will Smith.
See, already I haven't seen it and I knew how to make it a better movie.
See, right off the bat, it should have been Joel Edgerton's Zork. That's what it always should have been. The idea that the whole movie spends none of its time even thinking that an orc could be a bright. And that should be the big surprise, because he's the most likable character. Will Smith is kind of like Ridzik in Red Heat, where there is this unlikable quality to him, but he never really denounces his own overt racism.
You just don't get it, do you, Will Smith? You just don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know. So it could have been a hell of a lot better.
So from Netflix's point of view, I do think that it's best for them if they put out good movies. But failing that, do you want to put out interesting movies? Because Bright is an attention-getting subject, and so people are going to look at it and be like, "Oh, what's you know?" It's something that draws people to the platform. People want to check it out because of the cast, because of the subject matter. And I liked, you know, with Mute to take a director that hasn't done a lot but is interesting, and to be like, "Hey, you know, there's this project that you've been wanting to make for a while. You know, like here you go. I want you to." To flesh that out. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But the fact that they are, Netflix is willing to take chances of a type that I'm not really seeing from any of the traditional forms and studios. And it has the potential to create something really interesting.
The only one, I've talked about this before, the only other studio that I would lay that is A24. Mm-hmm. A24 is the only other where I was just like, well, now slowly Oscar is catching up to the idea that they allow their directors to make mid-budget films and do them the way they want to do them.
What is it they put out?
Well, they did Moonlight. They've done a bunch of stuff. They did Lady Bird, which came out. They did It Happened at Night.
Free Fire. They did... what else did they do? They've done a bunch of stuff, but it's always kind of lower to mid-budget movies that usually have a couple recognizable people in them done by filmmakers who can work within that kind of range. And there's a lot of good stuff there. And I think Netflix is kind of in that place too, that, you know what, if the cost of admission to get an occasional brilliant movie or TV show that isn't bound by the same kind of restrictions that TV has in terms of how long an episode is or content or any of that stuff, if the cost of that is I have to put up with occasionally seeing an animated thing telling me that there's a new Adam Sandler movie out, I can pay that cost.
Radio vs. the Martians is hosted by Mike Gillis and Casey Doran. This podcast is recorded in beautiful Val Verde in Seattle, Washington. Our chief engineer is Casey Doran, and our editor is Mike Gillis. Our original theme music was written and performed by Todd Maxfield Matsumoto. Special thanks to Sam Mulvey, Rob Kelly, James Wetzel, Paul Rue, Tobias Panshin, Scott Kramer, Kyle Hepworth, and Dan Lombardo. Please take the time to rate and review our show on iTunes and Stitcher, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you'd like to support the show financially, please consider becoming one of our Patreon subscribers. Even just $1 a month gives you access to exclusive episodes. And you can always find us online at RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
All right, this one's very tough.
He's having a good time. Good for you. Yeah, laugh it up. Enjoy your night.
Come on, Happy, concentrate.
Fight that clown.
Easy. If you can't beat the clown, how are you going to beat Shooter McGavin?